This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the distinguished historian Paul Kennedy, speaking with us today about how the winning of World War II had less to do with the power of weapons than with the force of mind. Your new book, Paul, comes with the title Engineers of Victory, The Problem Solvers Who Turned the Tide in the Second World War. You name five primary problems. When were they identified?
They were identified in a sort of crystallized form at the Casablanca Conference held under the auspices of Churchill, Roosevelt, and the Combined Chiefs of Staff in January 1943. The war had gone to its midpoint, but there were still many more things to be solved before victory could be achieved. And at Casablanca, they were named and identified.
And they are which ones?
How to get convoys safely across the Atlantic from America to Europe when they were being sunk at such an awful rate. How to get control of the air over Western Europe and Germany when our bombers were being shot down. How to help the Soviets defeat the Nazi blitzkrieg style of warfare, how to land on a hostile shore with a big amphibious operation, and how to get American forces 7,000 miles across the Pacific to defeat Japan.
You suggest that these problems were largely solved within a matter of 17 months.
It's true if you think about it, and I did not know this when I went into writing this book, starting off in 2008. In June to July 1944, you have not only the D-Day landings, you have the fall of Rome to Mark Clark's armies, you have the taking of the absolutely critical Mariana Islands in the Pacific, and you have the Soviets dealing with very greatest damage to the Wehrmacht on the Eastern Front in an operation we scarcely know about, called Operation Bagration. And in the meantime, behind that, we had won the Battle of the Atlantic.
You say that you want to talk about the how, that it's easy for masters and commanders to say, do this or do that, but it's easier said than done. And what are the principal elements of the getting it done? Is it a character of a kind of person?
This is a common problem, as anyone knows, in different organizations. There's some decision made at the top, whether it's the board of a company or whatever, let's get this done, let's establish a bigger hold in our market in Brazil, but how do you do it? And it's a combination of things. I'm not arguing for anything in particular, that is the magic potion. A good organization, a culture of innovation which allows people to experiment, an introduction of new methods, new technologies, in the case of war, new weapon systems like the long-range Mustang fighter. All of these cumulatively give you the advantage over the other side.
And this, we had this culture, we had the space for this, which the Axis powers did not. Explain some of the difference between, say, Roosevelt and Churchill on the one hand and the Japanese and the Germans on the other.
Let's start in reverse order. I don't think there's any evidence that I've come about that the Japanese encouraged innovation or encourage new weapon systems after Pearl Harbor. There's a very strong rivalry between the Japanese Army and Navy. They're using the systems that they developed so very well in the 30s, but were becoming outdated. In the case of the Third Reich, of course, there was massive technological and scientific talent, but it was often distorted by the peculiarities of Hitler's sense of priority. Willy Messerschmitt could build the world's best and first jet fighter, and Hitler would insist you put bombs on it to try to go and bomb the British. And before the jet fighter was useless. So when we move over to the Allied side, I think you have a much more relaxed Roosevelt, who feels certain of the American predominance of material power and that they will eventually just crush the opposition. But he does say yes when his old mate, Admiral Ben Moreel, comes along and says, Mr. President, we need to create something called Naval Construction Battalions, called Seabees. And Roosevelt says, go ahead and do it. Here's a presidential order. In the case of Churchill, you have the most astounding example of somebody who believes in a culture of encouragement. People who have not excited controversy in their career are unlikely to help us defeat the Nazis, he says on one occasion, when he promotes General Percy Hobart to build all of his weird and funny tanks, which are so successful in North Africa and Normandy. So I'm really interested in this thing from the businessman's viewpoint and the CEO's viewpoint. How do you get a culture of encouragement? The story of the engineers of victory is transferable.
Can you give us some specific example in any one of these five theaters of operation that, as to what came up to answer the emergent occasion?
Well, the big crisis of the Allied bomber campaign against Germany by 43 was that we had these larger number of long-range, especially daylight bombers, U.S. Air Force bombers operating out of East Anglia, flying to Germany, but they were unprotected. And the bomber did not always get through. In fact, it was being shot down in terrible and record numbers, and there was a desperate need for a long-range fighter which could be as nimble as the great German Focke-Wulf fighter, but could have enough capacity and fuel to go from Cambridgeshire to Prague and back. And nothing existed, no Thunderbolts, no Spitfires, no lightnings could do it. There was this miserable little thing called Pursuit Fighter 51, which had a weak engine, and one single Royal Air Force test pilot called Ronnie Harker, who we don't know anything about, flew it and said, let's put in a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine. And when it was put in the next day by Rolls-Royce engineers, it turned out to be something that he regarded as being aerodynamically impossible. And it could then fly and shoot the Luftwaffe out of the sky only 4 months before the D-Day landings. But he reported to a manager at Rolls-Royce, who reported to an air marshal at Royal Air Force, who, seeing the report, said, let's go for it, and let's tell the Americans immediately. This is what I mean by the culture of innovation, culture of encouragement, people whose minds were still open.
It's sometimes said that there were miracle discoveries like the Ultra machine or the immense capacity of America's manufacturing and production material, and also intelligence in general. But you say all of these things have their ups and downs, and they all have to work together.
Yes, indeed. I'm very skeptical of any single cause explanation of the victory, or a single battle explanation of the victory of the Allies in World War II. Intelligence worked when you can prove it worked by the defeat of the enemy in battle. In other words, the decrypts in the Pacific, which allowed Nimitz's forces to get at the Japanese at the famous Battle of Midway in June 42, are a testimony to the value of decrypts. But if you're sending all of these decrypts down to the Southwest Pacific to MacArthur, who orders his officers not to read them because they come from the goddamn U.S. Navy, then intelligence fails. If people are telling Chukov that a big German invasion, re-invasion is coming before Kursk in 1943, and Chukov wants to know where it's coming and what strength, and he knows it's coming, and intelligence is not so valuable. In the same way, the vast American productivity and the outflow of bombers, fighters, liberty ships is not so significant if they can't be shot down at the rate they were being shot down and the rate they were being sunk in the first half of 1943.
So it's not only force of weapon and power, but it's what you call the intelligent application of force. In other words, how to balance, because you have these five major theaters going on at the same time, and that has to be taken into account.
This was the task of the Combined Chiefs of Staff. That's the technical word for the American Joint Chiefs coming together with the British Joint Chiefs, and with all sorts of absolutely wonderful co-committees underneath them. You know, the Allied Committee on Intelligence, the Allied Committee on Shipping Allocation. Once you stop to think about this, you say, oh my God, you know, we can only produce so many thousand landing craft. How many go to the Pacific? How many go to the North African landings? How many go to England for the Normandy landings? How many go to Mountbatten for advancing down the Burmese coast? And the staff work is fantastic, but it needs the intelligent application. You finally have to say, well, Burma is not as important as North Africa, then Sicily, then Italy, and then we bring these landing craft away to the south of England and Wales, because the next biggest important thing is the Normandy landings. Now, there has to be an incredible number of really smart middle managers to do this.
And Nazi Germany doesn't have this. I mean, Hitler is attacking all over the map and diluting his force and won't listen to a middle management.
I was struck, Lewis, more than I thought I would be when I, you know, if an author's genuinely curious but doesn't have a prefixed notion of what the conclusion is going to be, you go in with a curious mind, then that's a great intellectual kind of attitude, because you find things that you didn't think were important beforehand. And in the Second World War, geography was incredibly important. We know it is in the Pacific, but for Hitler to be still fighting Britain and the British Empire, then attack the Soviet Union and expand far too far into it, then declare war on the United States, then send help to Mussolini in North Africa. His poor, shall we say, Luftflotten, the aircraft fleets, you can track them being sent to the Pas-de-Calais in northwest France, then move to Russia, then move to Italy, then move to North Africa, then move back to France, and you say, this guy does not understand geography and he does not understand logistics.
You also have a wonderful phrase where you say that war is the auditor of institutions.
Yeah. This is a phrase I borrowed from a great British historian of war, Mr. Corelli Barnett, where he says, the war does audit your institutions. That at the end of the day, you can look and say, well, on this side of a ledger, you did well, but on this side of a ledger, there were so many things you did wrong, and that's why you ended up in defeat. And I like that concept. It means that you're looking at the balance. There were so many strengths of Nazi Germany, and it's easy to list them all, including the extraordinary competence of the Wehrmacht in the field in battle after battle. But at the end of the day, the weaknesses relative to the other side's engineers of victory were just too large.
Looking back at it from today, it looks like victory was inevitable. But that's not the way it looked to people in January of 1943.
In January 43, after Casablanca, when Roosevelt steams home and Churchill flies home, the next month the losses of our merchant ships in the North Atlantic spring up, and the month after that, they go so high up in March 43 that the British Admiralty confidential history says this was the time when the new world was so close to being separated from the old world. The most dangerous time in the Battle of the Atlantic. And bear in mind, if we didn't win the Battle of the Atlantic, we couldn't do anything else. We could win in the Pacific, but nowhere could we win unless we won the Battle of the Atlantic. So they were scared stiff. Churchill, in his memoirs, says, "This was the campaign which frightened me most." So who turns it? Which systems? Which clever organizations? Which new weapons? Which new ways of thinking things? This includes encryption, but the obsession with intelligence as the answer is to me just so simplistic. It took about 6 or 7 new elements introduced by various people who are termed in the book engineers of victory. In the Webster definition, that an engineer is somebody who uses a craft to get things successfully achieved. This is what happens.
You have a wonderful example with the Battle of the Atlantic. I think to close the air gap in the mid-Atlantic, it's somebody in the Canadian Air Force that has an idea about how to re-rig a B-24 plane.
There are two things. So the air gap in the Atlantic was that zone in the middle Atlantic where the aircraft patrolling out of Newfoundland or Greenland or Iceland on the one hand, or out of Northern Ireland or Scotland on the other, none of them could cover this gap. And that's where the very smart German submarine admiral Dönitz had his U-boats attack. Because U-boats were scared stiff of aircraft, but here's a zone where there's no aircraft. So you may think in retrospect, well, that isn't, you know, everybody can see that, but it took the planners on the Allied side time both to see that and to do the statistics. The Second World War is when statistical science first appears, and then to say, well, how do we solve the problem? And the book is all about problem solving. So on the one hand, a number of Canadian flyers operating out of Gander and Newfoundland say, well, we are flying these large B-24 American Liberators, and we don't need masses of bombs to sink a submarine, so we could have space for an extra capacity of fuel, and therefore we could go further. So you create what we call the very long-range Liberator bombers. And then others on the U.S. side say, well, we can take a merchant ship and put a flat deck on it, and it's a sort of escort carrier with 6 or 10 Hurricane fighters on it, which goes along with the convoys. And if a U-boat is spotted on the surface, the Hurricane takes off from this rudimentary craft with its couple of 250-pound bombs, attacks a submarine, drives it down, and very often the Hurricane just ditches in the water and the brave pilot is pulled out. But you close the gap by people thinking of how to solve the problem.
Let me ask you, Paul, last question. I mean, your very famous book that you published some years ago, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, somehow, how does this relate to that? Is the fall of a great power, has that got something to do with its losing the capacity of its middle management and of its spirit of innovation and of its creativity?
I think so. I would say it's a fair question. How does the rise and fall of a great powers, with its emphasis upon the big long-term trends, relate to these stories of individual geniuses and individual eccentrics and individual weapon systems? I actually think they complement each other. I think that, for example, the fall of Philip II and Philip IV Spain was because they were running out of creative middle persons, middle colonels and generals. And the other side, the Dutch and the English were, say, especially at sea, adopting faster, more maneuverable ships. And in the same way, I think that the fall of Hitler's empire, you could say, well, you're very silly to try to take on the entire British Empire, a quarter of the world, the Soviet Union, and the United States, but you also fail because you do not have this necessary level and layer of creative, innovative people who were permitted by the Churchills of the world to have a go at some new inventions. So this middle level of war between the decision makers at the top and the grunts at the bottom is really what has excited me and made me feel that this book is, you know, the one which has thrilled me so much for so many years.
Thank you, Paul Kennedy, for speaking with us today about the engineers of victory who turned the tide of the Second World War. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News. Copyright Bloomberg 2013.